Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we get a local perspective on today's headlines, and some would say the history of the past 3,000 years, with a discussion of the intensifying war and turmoil in the Middle East, the escalation of the conflict between Israel and Hamas in the Palestinian territories, the rise of the self-proclaimed Islamic State ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and the use of terrorism to accomplish goals linked to cultural and religious conflicts that go back generations. We have two guests from central Wisconsin who have firsthand experience with the human impact of those conflicts. Terry E. Arnold is a retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. State Department who served in Egypt and Syria. He's the former chairman of the Department of International Studies at the National War College and the former deputy director of the State Department Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Management. He is author or co-author of 6 books on politically motivated violence, including Fighting Back, Winning the War on Terrorism, A World Less Safe, and his newest book, Let's Talk About Palestine. John Visti of Wausau has spent decades working in the Palestinian territories, Lebanon, and Egypt with American Near East Refugee Aid, or ANERA, CARE International, Associates of Rural Development, Save the Children UK, and Jumpstart International. He is currently the program manager of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service on the UW-Marathon County campus in Wausau, where this broadcast is originating. We're going to hear their thoughts, and we'd like to hear from you as well. It's in the headlines. This is your chance to talk to people who have experienced some of the culture that's behind the conflict firsthand. 1-800-780-9742 is our phone number. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Terry Arnold and John Visti, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning,
Glenn. Terry, you've got a long career as a diplomat in Egypt, Syria, India, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and Brazil. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you served as chairman of the Department of International Studies of the National War College, deputy director of the State Department of Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Management. Did that make you the number two expert on counterterrorism at the time?
In the State Department, yes.
Why are you writing and speaking out about the conflict in the Middle East when you could just be comfortably retired right now in Stevens Point?
Well, it's a very compelling situation from many points of view. I've been tracking it now for more than 30 years, and it has an important tendency to export to the United States, among other places, but particularly to the United States because of the close relationship between the United States and Israel.
You grew up in West Virginia. You worked in Washington at the State Department for a number of administrations. You worked under Republicans and Democrats. And you traveled the world as a diplomat. What brought you to Stevens Point?
My bride.
Well, there you go. And Yvonne is sitting in our other studio here listening in.
And she is a Wisconsin girl. And throughout our diplomatic career, we came to Wisconsin at least every 2 years. So we saw a great deal of the state. We had a number of friends here, and we still do. And it's a good place to be, actually.
Now, you grew your books include Fighting Back, Winning the War on Terrorism, Terrorism, the New Warfare, and that's a high school text, correct?
Yes, it is.
The Violence Formula and A World Less Safe, all of those focus on terror and the groups that use them. Is there a common thread in all of these books?
That's hard to say. I don't think there's a common thread in terms of the particular, that is, the substantive motivation of various groups. But there is a common thread that runs to the cultural needs, feelings, and interests of the various groups. That means we're all over the map in terms of specific pieces of philosophy. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll have a terrorist in the United States who thinks that the South is not dead and we should refight the Civil War. But that's one cultural subset. People in Louisiana who still have those historic recollections, that's very different from those same socially positioned people in, say, Egypt or India.
So there is a commonality with terrorism being used by groups all across the world, including the United States. What is that commonality? What causes groups to rely on terrorism in order to achieve their goals?
Well, they tend universally to be out groups, meaning the political leadership is not paying much attention to them or to their felt spiritual cultural needs.
Mm-hmm.
And as out groups, not getting attention to their causes through the normal processes of a political system, they will go to, okay, how do we get attention? And if it means throwing a bomb, they eventually throw a bomb, something like that. That will vary all over the map for time and place. But basically, that's the way it works. Frustration is the driver.
Has our plugged-in society, the 24-hour news cycle, the Internet, all of that, has that played into it by giving these groups a ready audience? They know that when they do something like that, people are going to find out about it all over the world.
They know that. They're not necessarily as happy as they could be about that because a lot of people who hear about them decided, I want to get rid of that guy. I want to get rid of that group. So, you know, there are two sides to the story. Getting publicity for your cause may be fruitful. It may be dangerous to your health, too.
You've got a new book. It's called Let's Talk About Palestine. It's available on Amazon and in print. Tell us about that.
Well, what I was trying to do with that book was give an up-to-date kind of perspective on all of the things that are going on in that region to help people understand just what they should be thinking about with respect to the needs, the interests, the rights of the various conflicting categories of people in the region, and particularly to understand just who in heaven's name is a Palestinian. Why is it that they are so put upon by the Israelis? What do the Israelis have against them? Questions like that.
Do you have a political aim in that book, or is it primarily educational? You're trying to let people know about the history of the conflict and the history of the people of Palestine.
Well, I don't have a political goal in I think the strict sense that you might have in mind. I have a political awareness goal in the sense that I think it's useful to have us know what those various groups stand for. What's bothering them? What difference does that make to us?
John Visti, you grew up in Wausau in a family of local community leaders. How did you end up spending so much of your life in the Middle East and working with the Palestinian people there?
It was, mostly by accident. In the early 70s, I spent a year in Africa and with some friends, an ex-history teacher from high school in Wausau, and I enjoyed, I just loved Africa, and then I thought, well, if I learned Arabic, English, and French, I could cover the whole continent. I could go anywhere. So I went back to school, and I took Arabic. And then I couldn't find a job in Africa, and I got hired by the American Friends Service Committee on their Middle East desk, and just one thing led to another.
Well, the American Friends Service Committee, just one of a number of non-governmental organizations, as they're called, that you've worked for.
Mm-hmm.
The others are America Mideast Educational and Training Services, Associates in Rural Development, CARE International, American Near East Refugee Aid, or ANERA, Save the Children UK. What role do these organizations play in helping to address some of the day-to-day problems of the people in the region, maybe roles that the governments there can't fill themselves?
Well, the nonprofit NGO organizations have been traditionally gotten involved for humanitarian assistance. They moved into countries to provide food, shelter, water in times of crisis, either civil unrest or natural crises. And there, later on, they in the 50s, well, in the 60s, really, they started doing more and more development work because the most of the assistance that was being provided to countries around the world was through bilateral aid prior to that. And the United Nations started providing some assistance, mm-hmm. but these non-governmental organizations began doing the development work and getting grants from the UN and countries to provide assistance.
Now, is the work of these organizations generally well received by the governments of the countries and the territories in which they operate, or is there conflict sometimes?
There is sometimes conflict. In most cases, it's well received. There are varying degrees of communication between the NGOs and the host governments. In some cases, for instance, in the West Bank and Gaza, when I first went there, that was occupied territory, it still is, and there was an aid memoir between the U.S. government and the Israeli government that essentially allowed us to do it.
Tell us about those years. You spent more than two decades there, correct?
Well, I spent about 10, 12 years in the occupied Palestinian territory and another 10 years in Egypt and a couple of years in Lebanon, yeah.
When you see the headlines of fighting between Israel and Hamas, the bombing of targets in the Gaza, the rocket attacks on Israel, the civilian casualties. What are your thoughts? It must strike pretty close to home for you.
I must admit it's despair sometimes because I don't understand why this cycle of violence keeps happening. It seems that there are so many people on both sides who are willing to talk. And yet there seems to be this inertia on both sides to keep the violence going. When I first went to Gaza back in late 70s, you could drive in. There were no walls. There were hundreds of thousands of workers who were coming into Israel and working from Gaza. Same in the West Bank. There was a lot of trade going on. Israelis would go to Gaza to the market to get food, and there was a lot of communication. Then after the first intifada, things began to get, that was in 1987.
Define intifada for people.
Okay, intifada is the uprising. Literally means uprising in Arabic. And there was a largely peaceful intifada in 87, 88 through about 93. And then a second intifada in 2001, and that was much more violent. And then walls began to be built, barricades, roadblocks, and there was no movement. But the real detriment in my mind to all of that was that there was no communication. People weren't talking to each other anymore, whereas there had been a lot of interaction previous.
And Terry, what are your thoughts? You worked as a diplomat in Egypt and Syria. You worked as a counterterrorism specialist with the State Department. When you see the conflict and the escalation of it with Hamas and Israel, what are your thoughts?
Well, one feature of the problem that's very difficult to deal with is the status of Islam in Western thinking. And that enters into this calculus for examining that situation specifically. You know, back in 2006, Hamas won the first really free and fair election in Palestine. And it won it not just from Muslims, it won it globally for Palestine. Properly speaking, they ought to have been leading the government of Palestine, but Fatah and Mahmoud Abbas did not want any part of that. So
Fatah was the other
party.
The other party that
the
had been
older,
in charge
older
beforehand.
Party, yes. And they had lost a free and fair election. That was embarrassing, to be sure, because they had lost it not only in Gaza, they had lost it in all of Palestine.
Did the U.S. play a part in trying to undermine the authority of Hamas after they won that election?
Well, I think the first thing they did to play a part in it was to rig a situation in which they removed Abbas from Gaza and left Hamas to run for itself. Left Hamas to run a region without the benefit of support from the central government.
We are told that Hamas is a terrorist organization, but yet, as you said, in a fair and free election, it was selected as a representative of the Palestinian people. How do you reconcile that?
Well, it's difficult to reconcile, but who is a terrorist is a tricky piece of analysis in the United States at this point. Anybody who throws a bomb is a terrorist. And what gets lost in that is, why are people driven to violence? What motivates them to think that the only way they're going to get attention is to throw a bomb or fire a shot or something like that? What's missing from the interaction equations of a community that causes some people to feel this is the only way they can be heard and the only way their interests and rights can be preserved or served? We don't do nearly enough examination of that. We just assume that somebody who's a terrorist is on the wrong side and should be dealt with as summarily as we can achieve. And that means we leave a lot of unsolved problems in the political landscape of a region like the Middle East.
How do you respond to people who say that you're coddling terrorists or you're being soft on them when you try to analyze them too much?
Basic response to that is simply, look, we have numerous outgroups in any society, and the only way we can live with each other in these days, particularly because weapons are so readily available to so many people in so many places, the only way we can live successfully together is achieve a dialogue and an interactive process that is basically peaceful for all concerned, that recognizes people's rights and interests, that particularly is sensitive to the cultural subsets that exist in numerous societies, including our own, and we work at the business of finding peaceful ways for us to live in the same space and interact successfully. We're not putting nearly enough time and interest into that.
John Vista, you were in Gaza when Hamas came to power. Your reflections on that moment in history and the support that the organization has from the Palestinian people.
I was in Gaza 2006, well, when the elections happened, and then later in 2007 when there was a gun battle between Fatah and Hamas. There was a huge amount of support for Hamas amongst the Palestinian population, both in the West Bank and Gaza, but that support was not necessarily for the religious values of Hamas. It was because Fatah was viewed as being a corrupt, inefficient organization that was no longer representing the goals and aspirations of the Palestinian people. And so, therefore, a lot of people supported Hamas. They did not necessarily support the violent takeover of Gaza by Hamas. That was not appreciated.
Terry, you wrote, and I'm going to quote you here, "Hamas has turned into the group that most precisely defines the goals of the Palestinian people, and that is why its candidates won the election. That, of course, is also why Hamas is roundly hated by the Zionists." And you write, "The U.S.-Israeli shell game is to try to keep Hamas labeled as a terrorist group and avoid having it function effectively as a political force." Can you expand on that for us?
Yes, that gets right to the nub of the problem of Hamas. The separation of power and authority that has occurred in Palestine that makes it impossible, virtually impossible anyway, to run Palestine as a community and as a country. We need to be, I think, very conscious of the complicated role that an organization like Hamas has to play. It's in a country only 10 miles wide and 25 miles long, if you look at Gaza. It has 1.8 million people. It has to feed, clothe, house, and protect those people in all circumstances, because nobody else is going to step in and do the job. Sure, United Nations Relief and Work does a fair amount of support. But you have here a group that both has to do all of those things and then has to defend its people against outside interference. And whatever else you might say about what the Israelis and the Zionists do, they frequently interfere with the capacity of Hamas to run the place.
What's the difference between an Israeli and a Zionist?
An Israeli is someone who chooses to be a Jew and wants to live in Israel. a Zionist is someone who wants to take over the entire territory and has been the leader politically and motivationally of the process of taking over all the territory of Palestine for the State of Israel. The Zionists were a group who came out of Europe. They had a historic leader, Jabotinsky. They have believed that it is their inalienable right to own Palestine, all of Palestine. They do not want Palestinians in it.
Are you saying that the creation of the State of Israel was a mistake? It was, you know, largely viewed at the time as being something that the Jewish people needed, a homeland, given the atrocities of World War II and the Holocaust.
Yes, but the particular Jews in question, the Ashkenazim Jews of Europe, were not in any way Palestinian. They were not in any way Israeli. They were Central European Khazars and their descendants who decided back in the 8th century that they would choose Judaism as a way to get out of the mess of politics around Christianity, Catholicism, in Europe. They did that, and it lasted for 400 years for them, I guess, plus or minus a nickel, before they were taken down. But none of those Jews were ever near Palestine. They are not Semitic peoples. They're Hamitic peoples, maybe. Or they're the third category, Japheth types.
But nonetheless, don't the Jewish people need a homeland like all people do?
Well, that's become less and less defensible as a strategy, that you can take a particular subset of a society and declare that they are entitled to their own space, their own unique space.
But isn't that the argument that's being used for the Palestinians, that they too deserve a homeland?
Well, they deserve a home, but they deserve a home in Palestine if the Israelis would put up with it. That's one of the solutions to the problem that many Palestinians favor, highly favor, is a single state, not a two-state solution, but a one-state solution that's a liberal, open, democratic society that recognizes all the players as equals.
So the State of Israel would also recognize the Palestinians as equals?
It probably would no longer be the State of Israel. It would be something, but it would be a state that gave equal right and opportunity to all the people in it. And right now, I think it's worth recognizing that if you did a head count on Palestine, all of Palestine, including those areas that are uniquely Israeli and those that are uniquely Palestinian, you would find that the populations are about equal, 6.5 million people who are Jews, 6.5 million people who are Palestinians.
Is there a danger that the Palestinian segment of the population will increase while the Israeli section does not, and you may eventually have more Palestinians living in Israel than Jews?
There is not merely a danger. I think there is a likely process because the Palestinians are more productive than the Israelis. This is a social phenomenon.
John Visti, you know, given these two groups of people living together in the same territory in equal numbers, have you ever thought of any possible solutions to this conundrum? How can these people live in peace? You say at one time back in the 70s, they appeared to be heading down that road.
I don't know. Depends how I'm feeling. I usually think it's a pretty remote possibility, but I do think in the long run it has to be a one-state solution. I don't think that there will be because the West Bank now is too fractured, and it's not an economically viable place.
We are told, you know, getting back to Hamas, we are told that Hamas deliberately uses schools, residential neighborhoods, hospitals as sanctuaries for their fighters and their armaments, and even uses women and children as human shields. Is that true?
I don't know. I haven't been there. I would imagine that they have probably put some weapons in some schools and mosques, but I have no way of knowing.
Mainly it's a good propaganda weapon.
Yeah.
Are the Israelis supposed to sit by as rockets rain down on their country and people burrow under the border through tunnels?
Well, this is a position that the Israelis would love to have us dwell upon, but that's only one side of the story. You have people in Gaza who are surrounded on all sides by hostile forces. And I do mean surrounded on all sides, because now even the Egyptians at Rafah and that sector of the border are on the Israeli side. And Hamas, therefore, has no friends in the surrounding area. And it has limited, if any, access to those surrounding territories, unless it digs tunnels that don't get discovered too quickly. And these are major tunnels, by the way. You can drive a truck through them. But they're stuck with the process of, if we're going to live, if we're going to survive, we need somehow to get out and get the things that are essential to our livelihood, medicines and foods, for example. And they're going to struggle with the process of how to do that. And from time to time, they're going to make some Israeli mad somewhere who will shoot at them, and they'll shoot back.
Terry, you've been harshly critical of the Israeli government, accusing it of ethnic cleansing. Those are your words, the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Do you stand by those words, and how do you react when people say that position is anti-Semitic?
It's not anti-Semitic because the key actors are not Semites. The key actors who are Semites are the Palestinians.
Explain why you, as a diplomat, someone who has worked for years in Egypt and Syria and was the number two counterterrorism expert in the Reagan administration in the State Department, why it is your opinion that the Israelis are responsible for what you call the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people?
Well, I'm not a unique person who believes that, but I've been watching it for a long time, and that's the way it plays out on the landscape. There's no question that this is the process that's actively being pursued by the Israelis. They do not want Palestinians on the landscape. Their map of Israel is clean. It's all Israeli. And there are two ways you could get that. One is the Palestinians voluntarily go away. And many Palestinians, indeed, are Jordanians at this stage. Many Palestinians are in Lebanon. Quite a number of them are in Syria. But still, the population of Palestine itself is about equal, as I've said, between Palestinians and Israelis. There's nothing you can do about that except ultimately face the need to work out a functional relationship between the populations. This is what the Israelis are resisting because they want all the territory to themselves.
Terry Arnold, a career diplomat, retired, living in Stevens Point. He was a diplomat in Egypt and Syria and one of the top counterterrorism experts in the State Department during the Reagan administration, author of six books on terrorism and the situation in the Middle East, and John Visti, who has spent more than 20 years working in Egypt and working in Gaza and working in the Palestinian territories for a number of non-governmental organizations involved in relief and economic development activity. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to weigh in, that's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum. Summer exhibitions feature 20th century printmaking, from New Deal era lithographs to Andy Warhol's pop art screen prints, on view through August 24th. LYWAM.org.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're getting local perspectives on the continuing conflict in the Middle East, and we're focusing quite a bit on Israel and Palestine because that's where our two guests have devoted a lot of their attention. We have Terry E. Arnold. He is an author and also a career diplomat, retired now, living in Stevens Point, spent time in Egypt and Syria. And John Visti, who worked for many years in Gaza and in the occupied Palestinian territory, doing economic development work. John Visti, what is day-to-day life like for the Palestinian people on the West Bank and Gaza?
It's quite a bit different now than it was, say, 10, 20 years ago. It's extremely restricted in terms of travel movement. People can't go. So the largest, well, not the largest town, but the kind of administrative town in the West Bank is Ramallah. It's only 15 minutes from Jerusalem. It's almost a suburb of Jerusalem. And yet, because there is a wall now around the entire West Bank and there are numerous checkpoints, it can take hours for a person to get just from Jerusalem to Ramallah. And so it's just, it's a series of frustrations, basically.
Are these like open air prisons, these settlements?
Not the settlements. I mean, the settlement.
I'm not talking about the Israeli settlements. I'm talking about where
Palestinians
live.
Are. Yeah. I mean, in an effect, yes. I mean, much more so in Gaza than in the West Bank. There is some movement that goes on, but it makes it difficult for people to get to work, to see their friends, to go to funerals, to have babies. There have been numerous cases of people who have been stuck at checkpoints in labor and have given birth at the checkpoint or the child has died.
How much anger, John Visti, has been generated by the Israeli settlements in the area?
I'd say that's probably the key irritant amongst the Palestinians is that they see these huge settlements growing up and enveloping their communities. The roads stop people from, they can't go on the settlement roads, the Palestinians can't. And so and they see their land, they can't, their crops, their olive trees have been taken down. It's the most difficult issue, I think.
And how do these people view the United States with our unwavering support of Israel?
The people in the Palestinians are genuinely supportive of the of American people. I've never had any animosity whatsoever from any Palestinian, even the most radical.
But, really?
Yes, really. I mean, never. But they don't hate us. They hate our policies. They hate our support of Israel. That's the issue.
Terry Arnold, we've been told that in 1947, 1948, the State of Israel was created out of largely unoccupied land, that the Israeli people took their ancient home on that unoccupied territory and turned it into a thriving new society. You're saying that's not true.
That's one of the most enduring falsehoods about the situation, is that Palestine was unoccupied at the time. Actually, there were millions of people living there when the first of the Israeli invasion began.
And what happened to these people?
Many were scattered, but many stayed. And the many who stayed are the ones who constitute the base of the present Palestinian population in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Yeah, we have often been told that you create the next war out of the ashes of the previous one. Is that what's happened here? We create a homeland for the Jewish people largely as a result of what happened in World War II, and now you've got a whole new series of conflicts that have arisen from that.
Well, the analogy is weak in this particular case because the ashes continually accumulate. There is no specific moment you can say this was decisive in the destruction of what, fill in the blank, and I'm going to go after the people who did that to me. This is a continuous process of punishment and confinement that the Palestinians live with day in, day out, and I think we need to be much more conscious of that fact.
Terry Arnold, you were the number two counterterrorism person in the State Department in the 80s during the Reagan administration when the attack occurred in Lebanon. More than 200 Americans died. What went through your mind and the minds of the people in the State Department when that happened? You were there.
Well, this was a real shock. We thought that the situation in Lebanon particularly was more under control than it actually proved to be. What we were not looking at was the order of difference among the four or so main political groups within that region. And we were not really studying just what Hezbollah was doing and why. We didn't understand South Lebanon, I think, is basically the core of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Reagan's response to that attack, he is it's been described as him basically pulling out our forces.
Well, you know, Lebanon is a tiny piece of real estate. You can't do a very large army thing there. And even one of the best armies known in the world in terms of armament and modern capability, the Israeli army, couldn't manage Hezbollah.
Why was President Reagan not criticized for the attack in Beirut that occurred under his watch, in which more than 200 Americans were killed, in the same way that President Obama has been criticized for the attack on our embassy in Benghazi, in which four people were killed?
Well, time and place has much to do with it. Who is in charge has something to do with it, too. But Obama has taken a lot of criticism from the Republican side of the House, from the Tea Party side of the House. And all of that criticism with respect to what happened in Benghazi is misplaced, untrue. There was no crime committed here by the President of the United States. No particular problem can be attributed to him because the ambassador of the United States in a country that happens to be fragmented decided to visit the other part of it, and it cost him his life. There's nothing we could have done about that. As a country, there's nothing we could have done about that. We knew about the animosities between the people of Benghazi and the people of Tripoli. Those are traditional, have been a long time. But we also chose to have an embassy that operated from Tripoli and dealt with the situation in Benghazi through a relatively small consular post.
And John Visti, you worked and lived in Africa. You've dealt with some of the problems in the Middle East. How do you react when you see what's going on overseas being used as fodder in political campaigns and political debate here in the United States? Wasn't politics supposed to end at the shores of the United States and not spill over into our foreign conflicts?
I woke up the other morning, Glenn, after reading a lot of particularly distressing news, and I was really depressed. I just couldn't shake it. And my wife told me, "You read the news too much, John. You've got to stop reading the news." So, I think politics has always spilled over, you know, into international conflict, and you see it. But one of the things that's interesting, one of the things that I found fascinating when I first moved to the Middle East was that a village kid from a little, you know, a small village in the West Bank, very remote, knew more about American politics than a kid from the suburbs of the United States did about their own situation. They're very well informed. They keep, and maybe it's because it's the old center periphery. Maybe the imperial powers, you know, convey their news better.
They're well informed, but our citizens are not that well informed, Terry Arnold. You're shaking your head. People can't hear that on the radio.
Too bad. Too bad. Well, it's a simple truth. These problems do not intrude on the average American quite as much as they intrude on the people who live there.
Right. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We've got to take another short break, and then we'll be back with Terry Arnold, who worked in diplomatic posts in Egypt and Syria and many other places in the world, and was one of the top counterterrorism experts in the State Department, and John Visti, who spent many, many years working in the occupied Palestinian territory, doing relief and economic development efforts. More after this on Route 51.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Greenwood Hills Country Club, Wausau, helping the community one round at a time with Make a Difference Mondays, a day open for all golfers to enjoy a round of golf while benefiting a Wausau area charity. Details at greenwoodhillscc.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Terry E. Arnold and John Visti. Terry is from Stevens Point. John Visti from Wausau. Spent a lot of time, both of them, in the Middle East, and they each have their own perspectives on the conflicts and turmoil and the cultural underpinnings of those, and they're sharing them with us today. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on our Facebook page, and I will read it on the air. Rich from Rhinelander writes, it comes down to this. Israeli children must be safe. Palestinian children must be safe. This hatred rooted in history must cease. It's complicated, but the children must be safe. These are brotherhood populations. Enough. And the silence here is deafening.
Yes.
Apparently that means you agree.
Totally.
Yeah. I know Rich. And I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Terry Arnold, you were harshly critical of the United States' use of waterboarding, indefinite detention, torture during the Bush administration. I'm going to quote something that you wrote. You say, and this is a quote, "Murder works to rid one of an enemy, but we consider that a crime. Physical abuse works to get one's way in rape, but we consider that a crime. Physical assault is one way to settle an argument, but we consider that a crime. However, what the advocates of torture are saying is that the systematic abuse and mutilation of an individual up to some point just short of death is okay as long as this is done to gather national security information. By this stretch of our moral fiber, we simply set aside the rules of humanity that were built into the Constitution."
Couldn't have said it better.
Well, you did say that, but what about the ticking time bomb scenario that we hear about, when you absolutely need to get that information right away in order to stop something terrible from happening?
Working on one individual at that point in time is probably not the best use of your time if you have a ticking bomb. You need to know where it is. You need to know what it's targeted on. You need to know all sorts of information, and you start by needing to know whether or not you're talking to the right guy. And we're not always very clear about that. And examining individuals at Guantanamo, we spend a lot of time stressing and questioning people who have relatively minor, if any, roles and key problems of concern to us.
How much of a problem to American interests is the continuing detention of people at Guantanamo?
It's bad for our global reputation because it says we run a prison farm to suit ourselves. We run it outside the United States so that the people of the United States don't feel particularly guilty about it. You know, if we put it in Louisiana, it would be a different matter.
And how much damage do you think was done to our interests by waterboarding, by the indefinite detention, by the outsourcing of prisoners, by the photos of Abu Ghraib? Did we lose the moral high ground as a country? Did we lose the authority to challenge the morality of some of the practices that we condemn around the world?
We lost the moral high ground. I think if you look closely at many situations around the planet, we lost the willingness of people to listen to us because we are no longer the purveyors of truth. And if you look at the number of close friends we have around the world who are dictators and leaders of oligarchic societies, our message that we are there to implant and support creation of democracies is no longer valid either. In short, we have lost our control of global political and economic truths. We once had a very good handle on that. We spoke it like it was. We defended that as a set of propositions, but we haven't been doing that for years. We've been pursuing interest. I think that's a correct statement. We've been pursuing our interests. We've not, in my judgment, been pursuing them particularly well.
Now, John Visti, from your experience with the people in Palestine, mm-hmm. how would things like this resonate with them?
I think very much. I wanted to say earlier, when I was in Lebanon, I worked a lot with the Palestinian refugee who are living in the camps in Lebanon. There's about 250,000. And they've been displaced two and three times. People who left originally Palestine, they went maybe to Jordan, went to Jordan, to Lebanon, and they've been displaced internally within Lebanon through all the conflict that's been going on. Those people can't work. They can't. They don't have citizenship. They can't travel. They can't own property. I mean, it is just where can you provide hope for these kinds of people? And if
But yet things yeah. are falling apart everywhere. Look yeah. at the rise of ISIS, and we've only got a few minutes left of this show, but I want to at least touch on that. You know, the argument for our role in the Middle East is when you have radical groups like this engaging in crucifixions, beheadings, kidnapping of young girls. We now have boots on the ground. In Iraq, once again, we've been doing airstrikes. Isn't that warranted against a country or a self-described Islamic State like ISIS?
Well, we've got a very complicated mix-up in what we stand for. You know, Americans strongly believe in the rights of Christians to run our country, if that should have happened in the political process. We have a very strong role for religion in our political thinking, and that's just the way it is. But what we're saying, and have been saying in the Middle East for some time, is Islam cannot have a similar role in governance of the people of the Islamic states. You can't have an Islamic leader and run the country with the religious leader in charge of it.
But isn't what's happening with ISIS, you know, absolutely beyond the pale from the descriptions of what's going on?
Yeah, but you see, I think we are partially responsible for their walking beyond the pale, as you put it, because we, by insisting that an Islamic society is a bad idea, have encouraged a certain group of people within Islamic society to say what we need is a pure Islamic Sharia law society that actually practices the Quran as its basic belief system. And actually, I think that our rejection of Islam has strengthened them. I could be wrong, but I think that that's a major factor in their success is their perceived rejection of us.
How do people in Stevens Point react to your views, Terry Arnold?
Well, they keep having me teach classes at the university, and nobody's tried to shoot me. And as a matter of fact, right now I'm the president of the LIFE program for the university, the Learning is Forever Continuing Education program.
And John Visti, you're also active with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Progress. Here on the UW Marathon County campus, and your worldview certainly colors some of the things that you do.
Absolutely, and we're trying to strengthen democracy in Wisconsin. That's our primary role. So I think I'm just doing the same thing I was doing overseas here.
Do you gentlemen have any hope for what's going on in the Middle East? Will we eventually achieve peace between these warring parties? And I want you to distill it just down to a couple of sentences because we're down to our last minute here.
We, I hope, are moving toward recognition that all the people in that region need to be left free to deal with their own problems in their own ways, that we can't export a solution from the United States and give them an answer to problems that are historic within their society. We need to back off and help them, if we can, without interfering actively in their quarrels.
John Viste, you've got the final word.
A friend of mine said, it took 100 years to get democracy in France. Let's give them a little bit of time. And I think I would agree with that. It's just, I think things are starting to move.
We want to thank today's guests, Terry E. Arnold of Stevens Point, retired senior foreign service officer of the U.S. State Department, whose books include Fighting Back, Winning the War on Terrorism, A World Less Safe, and his newest book, Let's Talk About Palestine. Also, John Viste of Wausau, former country director of American Near East Refugee Aid, or ANERA, in Beirut, Lebanon, currently the program manager of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of this show, you can hear it again in its entirety Friday night at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.